From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll learn about the long history of lumberjacking in Wisconsin's North Woods. Then we'll learn about the EAA. That's the Experimental Aircraft Association.
It certainly wasn't a factory-built aircraft. It wasn't a military aircraft. It wasn't a research and development aircraft. It was an honest-to-goodness personal airplane that people built and flew.
Plus, we'll learn about the origins of Dungeons and Dragons, rooted right here in Wisconsin.
To be considered great, you either have to be the first at something or the best. And Gary Gygax and Dave Arneson were the first. They were the first people to create a role-playing game. The term didn't even exist when Dungeons & Dragons was created. The term role-playing game came about to describe Dungeons & Dragons.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. The Lumberjack World Championship happens every year in Hayward, Wisconsin, in the state's Northwoods region. But why? WUWM's Maian Silver speaks with historian Willa Hammett Brown to find out. Brown is the author of the book Gentlemen in the Woods, Manhood, Myth, and the American Lumberjack. They talk about the area's logging history, how logging inspired timber sports, and the trajectory of women into competitions.
Can you tell me a little bit about that area, northern Wisconsin's timber industry, and like how it flourished? And for people who are geographically challenged, we're talking about like the northernmost part of the state, kind of like an hour to an hour and a half from Lake Superior.
Yep. Absolutely. It was part of a whole hardwood forest, the old white pine forest that covered the UP of Michigan and the upper part of the Mitten, then through that sweep of Wisconsin and the northern part of Minnesota as well, a huge piece of timberland. And the logging of that land was the single biggest real transformation of American landscape, one of the biggest transformations in American history. It was the height of lumbering when that part of the land was lumbered in the 1880s through about the 1910s. And it really is what allowed the Midwest to flourish. Chicago, Cincinnati, Cleveland, Omaha, all of these cities are built with Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Michigan Northwoods white pine. Hayward itself was actually kind of famous. It was one of each state had a few of these wild towns that really could be compared to what we think of as Western cow towns. In fact, there have been studies done that the logging towns of the upper Midwest had higher crime rates and violence than the sort of famous old Wild West towns. And Hayward was one of Wisconsin's famous dens of iniquity, which is why it's very cool that it's where they now do the Lumberjack World Championships. It feels incredibly apt that they would come back home to Hayward. It was a remarkable time that has been sort of lost to history on purpose, because in many ways, there's a great quote I love from a woman who watched this herself, who was the daughter of a lumber camp owner, who referred to the logging of the upper Midwest as an epic and a tragedy. And it was epic in scale, and it was tragic in outcomes. So we celebrate parts of it. We celebrate this sort of mythical, made-up idea of what a lumberjack was about, and we very purposefully forget other parts of it about environmental destruction, poverty, fire, and all the other side effects that were really fairly tragic, particularly in Wisconsin, actually.
Logging and lumberjacking was a traditionally male-dominated profession. What was the role and history of women in this industry?
Yeah, that's a great question. It really was an extremely male profession, to the point where women were banned in most camps. Women were seen as possible distractions and possible ways of tearing apart the camps. Towards the end of the 19th century, you've got these camps of 80 to 150 men working together. And so drinking, gambling, and women are banned and seen as ways to lower morale. In smaller camps, women would be employed, and even in some big camps, in the cook shack. Often in very small camps, that would just mean the foreman's wife was the cook. But there were cooks and cookies who were, cookies being a cook's assistant, who were women who were hired. The real largest group of women to follow the lumberjack trade were sex workers and prostitutes. There were brothels across the upper Midwest. A lot of these small towns would be, you know, I'm thinking of Seney, Michigan, a town that out of season had a population of 400, but had 7 brothels, I believe. So it's not the 200 men of that town who are keeping 7 brothels going. It's lumberjacks who are doing that. And you really didn't see women even in the summer. The spaces men were in were very male dominated. These taverns were very male places. And the few women who were in them would either be the daughters of tavern owners who would be working, or these sort of notorious women along the style of, if you think of like a Calamity Jane in the West. So they're really, the opening up of lumbering to women is an extremely modern phenomenon.
You're tuned into Lake Effect. I'm WEWM's Maayan Silver, speaking with Willa Hammett Brown, historian, speaker, and writer. We are talking about women in lumberjacking, and you said it really wasn't a thing until modern times. Before that, I want a little nugget about how lumberjacking became timber sports, or, you know, that kind of competitive lumberjacking.
Of course. It's a really interesting story because it's also the story of how we changed what we think of as lumberjacking. So logging still happens, obviously. Forestry is still a big industry in this country. But right today, it requires much more specialized knowledge of machinery than it does of shimmying up logs or log burling. That's the log rolling in a river. Those skills are attached to a largely dead form of the industry. They're attached to a sort of nostalgic late 19th, early 20th century idea of what lumbering was and the way lumbering happened in the upper Midwest, in the North Woods, in these winter camps where these skills were really prized. There were some competitions that began while lumbering still existed. We have burling competitions happening in the late 19th century around in Michigan and Minnesota. And some of those were actual lumberjacks sort of showing off in the summer, and there started being money made out of that. But it really takes off when we get the full-blown nostalgia for the old, ye olde lumberjacky. And that nostalgia bears very little resemblance to the actual industry. So after the industry left in the 1920s, the Northwoods were just totally devastated. The largest fire in American history was the Peshtigo Fire, which was one of the deadliest fires as well, may have killed up to 1,200 people. You get these fires just devastating huge swaths of landscape. And in Wisconsin in particular, in the 1930s, there was actually a second Dust Bowl that no one talks about, which was in the cutover region of northern Wisconsin, the area we're talking about. So you have these economically devastated regions, also damaged by fire. There's not a lot that's easy to recover industry-wise around there because pine grows in sandy soil, and sandy soil doesn't make for great farming soil. So what the region turns to is tourism as a way to recover. And, you know, still, if you've ever spent a beautiful weekend at the Apostle Islands, you know that northern Wisconsin is a lovely place to go as a tourist. And at the same time that that region is turning to tourism, there's also sort of a national nostalgia for the closing of the West and a national nostalgia for what is seen as these sort of true white heroes of the West, the cowboys, the lumberjacks, your Johnny Appleseeds. And a lot of this has to do with just changing ideas of what it is to be a man in modern society. It has much more to do with factory work or office work. You're not out there doing things. And so there becomes a lot of nostalgia for that work. And by the 1930s and 40s, there start being these fairs with reenactments. And that's where you start seeing timber sports really take off, as it's a celebration of raw, really raw masculine strength and skill. it doesn't really bear a resemblance to the actual industry, which was a pretty standard industry in late 19th century terms, which is to say poor workers with very little way up, really bad conditions, terrible wages, very little respect for management for the actual workers themselves. It was a real industrial scale extractive industry, but what we celebrate about it is a sort of smaller scale folksy interpretation of that.
Well, two things. So the lumberjacking trade is traditionally just felling trees, right? I mean, would that be the biggest skill that you need to have?
There are actually a lot of really important skills in lumberjacking trade. So there is felling trees, which requires you to have an understanding of how trees are going to fall. That ability to look up and see, predict the direction it'll fall, to notch it in the right place and fell it, which is part of lumberjack competition still. Bark stripping, log stacking, which used to be in the late 19th and early 20th century, that was the big show-off thing, is to how high you could stack a load of timber, and you get these like 10-ton stacks of timber that were totally impractical. They were just to show off. They make really cool photographs of these dudes standing on these 30-foot piles of these sleigh rides of logs. You would then, while it was still frozen, use ice roads to get those to the side of the river. And once the ice thawed, those would be pushed into the river and driven down the river. And that's where a lot of the really high-skilled work comes in, of being able to find out which logs you need to move along to stop a jam, of being able to walk across the logs on the river, which is where you get log rolling from, is that ability to balance on those logs as you're trying to keep them moving down the river. It was both highly skilled and incredibly dangerous work.
Is it kind of a myth, the idea that these lumberjacks would come back to town after days of lumberjacking and then they'd try to have competitions with each other to be like, who's the best at this? Is that sort of like a myth?
It did start happening in the late 19th century, but really what happened is after a season of lumberjacking in the woods, they came to town, drank themselves silly, and spent all their money. The real thing they did was they called it the spree, and they were damn proud of it. And the spree was essentially an attempt to see how quickly you could blow all of your earnings on drink and gambling and women. And then, you know, if you had some time in there to roll some logs, sure, but you were probably drunk. And you can think of it like a rodeo. It's not that cowboys didn't need the skills that are shown in a rodeo, but that's not what being a cowboy looked like.
Gotcha. Okay. And so then how we were talking about this modern trail of women into this. What about women into timber sports? Like, how did that start?
My understanding is that it started 20 or 30 years ago, but really took off in the last sort of 20 years. I think part of the thing about lumber sports and timber sports is they are so distinctly masculine, in that they are this nostalgic exercise in showing the skills of an all-male industry. And all of the nostalgia is for this sort of mythologized and deeply problematic, but whatever, image of the white frontier male hero. And I just love that women have taken to going into that space and showing that they can hold space there. I think about it sort of like, when you think about men's and women's sports, it's like taking on football rather than taking on, I can't think of another sport that's less distinctly masculine, but it's
going back to,
yeah, soccer, I guess. It's going into the most male-coded space you could possibly find and showing that you can do it. Which I find incredible, and I think speaks a lot to the appeal to women, is that there are all sorts of places you can compete, but to choose to compete on grounds that are so tied up with our ideas of what it is to be a man is awesome.
That's a nice description of the trajectory. Willa Brown, thank you so much for speaking about lumberjacking, the history of it, and women in the sport. It's been very interesting.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now the flies are thick and the men get sick, it's cold as it can be. Nothing's unexpected in the North Country.
Willa Hammett Brown is a historian and the author of Gentlemen in the Woods, Manhood, Myth, and the American Lumberjack. She spoke with WUWM's Maian Silver. And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. In about 10 minutes, we'll hear new music from local musicians in the Milwaukee Music Roundup. But first, the EAA Air Venture Festival is happening now in Oshkosh. We'll learn about the EAA and how it began. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Way, hey, another brand new day on the wild and windy shores of old Sapirai. Way, hey, another brand new day on the wild and windy shores of old Sapirai.
You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The EAA is one of the world's biggest organizations for aviation enthusiasts, and it was founded right here in Milwaukee. The EAA is perhaps best known for its museum in Oshkosh and its annual Air Venture Festival, which kicks off today. Dick Napinski is the Director of Communications for the EAA, and he joins me to talk about it. I think when I heard the full name of the organization, the Experimental Aircraft Association, it almost sounded foreboding, a little dangerous. When we say the term experimental aircraft, what does that actually mean?
Yeah, experimental is a term used by the Federal Aviation Administration as a classification for people who build their own airplanes and in other uses as well. And it is a little bit of a misnomer. When you talk about experimental category aircraft, they're very often airplanes that are built from very standardized kits. There are thousands of these particular models in the air, about 1,000 new home-built aircraft that are put in the air every single year. So when this started to become something in the early 1950s, the FAA or its predecessor, the CAA at the time, really didn't have a place to put this new classification of airplanes. It certainly wasn't a factory-built aircraft. It wasn't a military aircraft. It wasn't a research and development aircraft. It was an honest-to-goodness personal airplane that people built and flew. So with a lack of any place to put it, they tucked it in the experimental category, and there it has stayed ever since. And hence, when a group of people who built their own airplanes got together in Milwaukee back in January of 1953, they started calling it the Experimental Aircraft Association. But in the aviation world, it's known simply as EAA.
Now, we'll talk about the origins of the EAA in just a moment. But when we look at the folks who are members today, who's a member of this organization? Is it largely people who are building and flying their own planes?
It is people who are interested in recreational aviation in all of its forms. It could be people who build their own airplanes, and that really is the organization's legacy in a lot of ways. People who restore aircraft, people who simply fly aircraft, or those who simply love being around the idea of personal flight, that freedom that it gives a person, that ability to do what man has wanted to do for tens of thousands of years, and that's soar with the birds. And in the past 120 years, we've been able to do that. And so the people who are EAA members are those who have a passion for flight, whether it's as a pilot, a builder, or maybe just a dreamer. They're all part of the organization.
Now, the EAA today has grown into a huge organization, but it has very humble origins. Can you tell us a bit about that story?
It does have humble origins right in the Milwaukee area, and that's part of the fascinating story. Paul Poberesny, who was a Milwaukee native, grew up in the area, went to West Milwaukee High School, and grew up in that part of town. And when he got out of World War II and later the Korean War, where he was a veteran, He always had a fascination with flight, going back to his high school days when he was given a trainer glider by a history teacher, and Paul remanufactured it and put it together and went up for his first flight being towed behind a car, and went up, and he always said he learned very quickly to keep the nose up because things otherwise go. And so when he got back from the war, he had been talking to a group of people who were informally building their own airplanes. He said, why don't we start an airplane club so we don't have to meet in people's garages and airplane hangars and so forth. So they started a club on January 26th, 1953. There were about 35 people who came to what's now Timmerman Airport, the Grand Air building at Timmerman Airport, then known as Curtis Wright Field, on the northwest side of Milwaukee, and had that first meeting. They decided to call themselves the Experimental Aircraft Association, had yearly dues of the princely sum of $5, and started right there. And it was a very humble beginning, but it quickly grew to include others throughout the country who heard about this and wanted to be a part of it. And Paul then also stepped forward. He wrote an article in the mid-1950s for Mechanics Illustrated on how to build an airplane for less than $800. And that really got the attention of a lot of people who were hobbyists and aviation enthusiasts and so forth, and started the organization on its way. And it's grown today to include 270,000 members from more than 100 countries. All of those people are passionate about the freedom of flight and sharing that feeling of flight with others. And that's where we are today with EAA.
It's interesting looking at the origins. My grandfather was someone who flew in World War II, and there are so many veterans for whom this was a huge part of their service, where they were in planes all the time. They come back, maybe some become pilots, but so many go on to other things. And to have this kind of space where you can engage in something that was so much a part of your life is a really interesting experience. When you look back into the history of the EAA, what are the things you're most proud of?
Well, you're exactly right when you talk about veterans coming out of World War II and the Korean era. We trained so many pilots, tens of thousands of pilots during that era, who got a taste of flight. Maybe it was the first time they'd done that. We want to go fly with the Navy or the Army Air Forces, and came back and wanted to continue to fly. And this was a way they could do it economically. And they supplied the first great impetus of the organization in its membership. But when you take a look at what EAA has done through the years, it created an entirely new segment of recreational aviation where there was not one before. You had a few hobbyists throughout the country who would build their own airplanes as back early. Well, I guess you could say the Wright brothers were the first airplane builders. But you know, there were people building Heath airplane kits back in the 1920s, building things such as Pitot poles, but really formulating that together to standardize it, to say, here's what we want to do. Here's what we want to do to improve safety. Here is what we're looking for, how to share it, and so forth. So some of the things that we're most proud of, first of all, is bringing that element of standardization to amateur-built aircraft and looking toward ever-improving safety. Another thing we're very proud of is what our fly-in, our convention has become in Oshkosh every year, the world's largest fly-in convention with more than 10,000 airplanes and more than 600,000 people in attendance. Also, we're very proud of sharing the legacy of flight with a new generation. And as we look ahead toward the technology, toward the possibilities in flight, we're very enthusiastic about that. Our Young Eagles program has flown almost 2.3 million kids free of charge to introduce them to aviation. And a lot of those young pilots now are out there flying for the military or for airlines. And it's incredible to see. So those type of things, maintaining the legacy of home building, bringing people together in a way to enjoy it, and looking out for the future are probably the three things that we're most proud of in the organization.
Well, I look forward to seeing what is next for the EAA. Dick, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Dick Napinski is the Director of Communications for the EAA, the Experimental Aircraft Association. We spoke in 2023. The EAA Air Venture Festival begins today and runs through Sunday. The summer seems to be flying by here in Milwaukee, but there's still a lot more for us to enjoy, including a lot of new music from local musicians. Every month, we talk about some of the best new songs from the city with Milwaukee Records' Matt Wild. But this month, we're looking at a mix of new and old songs, including one from John Kester, also known as Kid Millions, who died earlier this month. Matt Wild, as always, thank you for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me back.
We have a great list of songs this month. I will say the first couple names of bands threw me off at first, especially this first one, Oh Well Okay.
Oh Well Okay, yes, which is one of these bands that just always bugs me when I have to write about it because there's a comma in this band. There's something about band names with commas that just drives me as a writer and an editor up the wall. But they have a newish record out. Great Milwaukee band. The name of the record is Infinite Monkey Theorem. The song we're going to be listening to is Mount Sonoma. Now, Oh Well Okay, it's one of these bands that I've seen their name around a ton, and for some reason, they've just kind of flown under my radar. I don't know why that is. Maybe it's the comma in the band name. I don't know. But I finally sat down one day, listened to this group, and listened to this record, and I was like, oh gosh, I really, really like this. Very shambling, kind of slacker, very 90s indebted indie rock. The song we're going to listen to is Mount Sonoma, a great example of that. The rest of the record, also very good, a little bit noisier than this song, but this is a great song. Oh Well Okay, they play out a lot, so there's plenty of chances to see them. So this is Oh Well Okay with Mount Sonoma.
Sonoma by Oh Well Okay. The next song, another name that is very interesting, although I feel like it alludes to their sound. It feels very 60s throwback. It reminds me a lot of the Mamas and the Papas.
Absolutely, yes. This is a newish band, actually a very new band, called Wisconsin Space Program. Apparently, Wisconsin has its own space program, and they are represented here in this terrific group. They just put out a record called Sun in Your Hands, and the song we're going to be listening to is the title track from that record. This is, I don't know if I would call a super group of sorts, but it definitely involves a lot of Milwaukee scene veterans, people who have played in groups like the Delta Routine, Antler House, Yum Yum Cult. It's a trio. But it's great that they've kind of found themselves and put this group together. Like you said, very 60s inspired. I would say even maybe kind of 60s by way of the 90s, kind of the 90s resurgence of that sound too. At least that's my reference for it. So this is another terrific record from them. It's called Sun in Your Hands. And the song from Wisconsin Space Program that we're going to listen to is also titled Sun in Your Hands.
Something in your mind. Here
In Your Hands by Wisconsin Space Program. The next song, it feels somehow like a stepped-up video game song, if that makes sense.
Also very 60s indebted, this song, from Milwaukee music veterans Trolley. Now, Trolley has been around, I think this year they're celebrating their 30-year anniversary. They've been around since the 90s. And sadly, a couple of years ago, the lead singer from Trolley, Mike Parrotto, passed away in 2021. Ever since then, in the ensuing kind of 4 years, the rest of the band, including Terry Hackbarth, the owner and operator of Irving Place Records, the rest of the band have kind of been using some material that Mike had recorded before he had passed and have been slowly kind of assembling this album, which is to be called A Carnival of Gray and White. It's going to be released in October. They've been working on this for, like I said, 4 years, ever since Mike passed. And it serves as a tribute to Mike, who, like I said, had been a Milwaukee scene stalwart for many, many years with Trolley and other groups. Also, the title track, A Carnival of Gray and White, a really, really lovely song, and I think a fine, fine tribute to Mike. And it's nice to see Trolley back again. It's been a while since they've had a record out. Certainly sad that Mike has passed, but like I said, this is a lovely tribute to him. So this is Trolley with A Carnival of Gray and White.
Procrastination, a carnival of gray and white. Footprints I follow down, calling up all reasons unknown. Consider it a total write-off, to contemplate a total loss. Well, maybe we should start all over again.
A Carnival of Gray and White by Trolley. With older bands in mind here, this next song is actually 16 years old, but we are revisiting it today because Kid Millions, also known as John Kuester, recently passed.
Yes, as many, many know, Kid Millions, John Kuester, passed away in July. And to many who knew him, this, I mean, was a huge, huge loss for the Milwaukee music scene and just music in general, I think. John performed under the Kid Millions names for many, many years. He was also one of the co-owners of Dope Folks Records, along with Chris Shulist. Together, those two are responsible, and other folks like Andy Noble and others, really responsible for like kind of just digging up and resurrecting so many forgotten hip-hop songs from Milwaukee's past, from the 70s, 80s, and early 90s. They've released so many fascinating, so many fantastic records on Dope Folks over the years, and they've done so much in that regard. And John, like I said, also performed under the name Kid Millions. So the song we're going to be listening to is from him. It's called Victim to the Beat. It's from 2009. And like I said, this was just an awful loss for a Milwaukee music scene. I didn't know John personally, but I certainly knew his music. I certainly knew his reputation. And it's just, it's a huge loss. But the music lives on. And this is a fantastic song. It's Kid Millions with Victim to the Beat.
time of rapping into defeat. All the haters get lost, hide heads, defrost. Step away, don't talk to me. I don't like your kind, it's a waste of time. It's a weak design, gotta redefine. Gotta walk the line, stand a test of time. Make it yours, not mine. Let it pour, let it shine to the core, get in line. Step way to the back, you're a pain in my back. You missed your turn, say Jack. Same ball, same bat, channel that through your inner whack. No way to give it back. Middletown gotta give you rap, that'll make your neck snap. I'ma get a S stamps on my chest, so fresh, so ill, so real. Man, go and get a record deal. I'm a victim to the beat, what your eyes don't see. I'ma fly so free.
Victim to the Beat by Kid Millions, also known as John Kester, who died earlier this month. Now, we are in kind of the heat of summer here. Of course, there's a lot that's going on in Milwaukee. What are you looking forward to?
I'm looking forward to air conditioning. I'm looking forward to relaxing. No, this is, yeah, like you said, we're in the thick of it here. We have a lot of stuff in our past. Summerfest is in the rear view mirror already, but there are about, I would say, 19 to 32 more cultural festivals down at the lakefront. There's still a lot of summer. I was just talking to my brother the other day, and we were kind of lamenting how quickly the summer goes by. But looking ahead, there's still a lot of summer to go. And so I'm living in the present. Every single day, there is something going on in Milwaukee with live music. You can find all that and more on MilwaukeeRecord.com. We have our big summer music series guide. And there is, like I said, literally something every single day from now through the end of September that's going on in Milwaukee. So I'm just looking forward to doing more. And more.
Very nice. Well, Matt Wild, as always, thank you for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me.
What you hear is not a test. I'm a rapping into defeat.
Matt Wild is the co-founder of Milwaukee Record. Every month, he joins Lake Effect to talk about some of the best new music from local bands. At WUWM.com, you can find all of our previous conversations. Did you know that Dungeons & Dragons and the concept of role-playing games were created right here in Wisconsin? We'll explore the history next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
On my chest, so fresh, so ill, so real, man, go and get a record deal. I'm a victim to the beat, which your eyes don't see. I'm a fly so free. Won't stop till I get enough. Won't stop till the crowd knows me. I'm a victim to the beat, which your eyes don't see. I'm a fly so free. Won't stop till I get enough. Won't stop till the crowd knows me. Now what's my name? It's a K-I-D from the 414. Yeah, the town you ignore. Skip when you want.
This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Dungeons & Dragons revolutionized the gaming world when it was first released in the 1970s. Not only did the game become hugely popular, it revolutionized tabletop games and created a new category now known as role-playing games. But did you know the first game of Dungeons & Dragons happened right here in Wisconsin? In fact, the game and the company it created were founded in Lake Geneva. A book called Slaying the Dragon unveils this history and the controversy surrounding it. Author Ben Riggs joins me to talk about it. I will say, as I've talked to other people throughout the state of Wisconsin, they're always surprised to learn that Dungeons & Dragons was created here. Is that something that you ran into as you were doing this?
Very much so. My book, Slaying the Dragon, A Secret History of Dungeons & Dragons, started out as an article for Geek & Sundry when my editor was like, hey, somebody should write an article explaining that Dungeons & Dragons wasn't always made in Seattle by Wizards of the Coast. And being in Wisconsin, born and raised here, I got the job. So I set out to write an article explaining that to millennials that, hey, Dungeons & Dragons actually started in Wisconsin. One article became three articles, which then became a 100,000-word book. And yeah, I still to this day, especially among new gamers, get people surprised to hear that Dungeons & Dragons' roots actually are here in southern Wisconsin.
So I want to explore this history a bit. We won't go into every facet of the book, although as a person from Lake Geneva, I do find it fascinating. But I'd like to first explore Gary's history a bit because his legacy is so much a part of this story. How would you describe the young Gary Gygax.
Well, first I want to say credit where credit is due here. The people that did the primary work on Gary Gygax are Michael Whitwer in his biography Empire of Imagination and John Peterson in a volume called Game Wizards. And I highly recommend anyone interested in Gary Gygax picking those books up, although mine covers it as well. But the moment of young Gary Gygax's life that I think is the most important to our story is he had quit his job in Chicago. He was working at an insurance company, although there's also some versions where he's fired, as I recall. And he has a young family in Lake Geneva. He has a wife, three kids, and he is making a living cobbling part-time in his basement in Lake Geneva. He's also incredibly active in the wargaming community in southern Wisconsin. And a guy named Dave Arneson comes down from Minnesota and goes into Gary Gygax's basement and runs a game for him that he was calling Blackmoor. And it's this game where you take on a single character and you go and you explore this dungeon. And your characters persist from session to session. You don't get a different character every time. And your characters improve with time. And Gary Gygax is kind of blown away by this experience, and he says to Dave Arneson, hey, why don't we get these rules out there? Let's collaborate and make rules for this game. And that is the beginning of the collaboration that results in Dungeons & Dragons, which is going to take Gary Gygax from being a part-time cobbler who's, as I recall, on welfare to an independently wealthy man within just a handful of years. He will be the CEO of his own corporation, and just that rapid ascent from cobbling in your basement and being on welfare to buying a mansion in Lake Geneva, which, as I recall, they renamed Dragonlands, is a staggering ascent. It brings to mind Ulysses S. Grant going from being a leather worker in Galena, Illinois, to president in less than 10 years.
Now, at this point, Gary had created another game, and it's my understanding that that is part of why, not just Dungeons & Dragons, but his first game is part of why he's considered the father of role-playing games. I think this book both confirms that narrative but really complicates it. What do you think of that assertion, and how do you untangle that web?
Well, geeks have been arguing about this for decades. But the relationship between Gary Gygax and Dungeons & Dragons co-creator Dave Arneson is fraught, complicated, thick with litigation, because although I would certainly say the game is a result of both of them working in concert, and for a simple evidence of why, neither of them ever really designed anything else amazing. To be considered great, you either have to be the first at something or the best. And Gary Gygax and Dave Arneson were the first. They were the first people to create a role-playing game. The term didn't even exist when Dungeons & Dragons was created. The term role-playing game came about to describe Dungeons & Dragons. And you can go back now and read about the correspondence they had. And it certainly seems like Gary Gygax was trying to capture on the page something that Dave Arneson was doing with his gamers up in Minnesota. Again, this really unique style of gaming. If it were not for Gary Gygax, Dungeons & Dragons probably would have remained just a game that Dave Arneson played with his friends on the weekends in Minnesota. But I do think that after the event, Gary tried to write Dave out of the history. For example, some of your older listeners may know that there used to be Dungeons & Dragons and another game called Advanced Dungeons & Dragons, which Gary Gygax claimed was a totally different game that had nothing to do with Dungeons & Dragons. Therefore, they didn't have to pay Dave Arneson any royalties on Advanced Dungeons & Dragons. And again, you had this weird splitting of the game in two. Dave Arneson eventually sued, being like, I am still the co-creator of Advanced Dungeons & Dragons because it's just another iteration of Dungeons & Dragons. And judges sided with him and required that he be paid royalties on certain Advanced Dungeons & Dragons sales. So because tabletop role-playing games have gone on to clearly be a radical new medium, very strange that you have a radical new medium created with paper and pen thousands of years after those technologies were created, but there we are. And once it became clear how important Dungeons & Dragons were, that's when you kind of got those two scrapping both over credit and money. Because for the first 10 years or so, there was money. You had years that TSR was moving tens of millions of dollars. And again, that's within a decade of him being on welfare. So it's understandable why the two would begin to fight over both the credit and the money. But if you wanted me to break it down in a simple fashion where I'm not giving you a long story, I would say that Gary was a popularizer. Dave was probably an innovator. But Gary still had his finger in a lot of the pies. Like, there's a lot of things that you would think of as Dungeons and Dragons that were uniquely Gary. I'm sure a lot of your listeners know what alignment is and have seen memes on Facebook and Reddit and Instagram where you see lawful good, neutral good, chaotic good, and there's pictures in the background. You know, Gary Gygax created that. That's unique, a unique piece of Dungeons and Dragons created by Gary Gygax.
Well, and it seems like TSR was largely a project of Gary Gygax's. When I think about Dungeons and Dragons, I do think about TSR, in part because I'm from Lake Geneva. The offices were a couple blocks away from where I grew up. How transformative was this company for what at that point was still a very small town? It remains a very small town, but was even less of a destination than it is now.
I would certainly say that Lake Geneva never really felt like they knew what to do with TSR and Dungeons and Dragons. A lot of the people who worked at TSR were not from Lake Geneva. You had a few Lake Geneva hands there, like Skip Williams is someone that comes to mind. Mary Kirchhoff graduated from Badger High School with Ernie Gygax, and she went on to revolutionize the novel department at TSR. But you had people coming in from Ohio, Georgia, Tennessee, Kentucky, New York City for that matter, converging on Lake Geneva to work at what was kind of a dream factory. And yet, explaining what Dungeons and Dragons is to someone who's never seen a game can be exceedingly difficult. You can go back and you can look at newspaper articles from the 1970s where journalists burn column inch after column inch trying to explain what you actually do in a game of Dungeons and Dragons and not necessarily illuminating the matter at all. And if the game is that hard to understand, it makes sense to me that Lake Geneva would just be like, so they make this game and there's dragons and wizards, and then you have to throw in the stress of the satanic panic in the early 1980s. So not only is TSR making this weird new game that no one in the community understands, but now I'm hearing on TV that they might be summoning demons and causing suicides and all this stuff. So it makes sense to me that the town itself would have a lot of mixed feelings about it. It seems like they're coming around to embrace it now. There's conventions in Lake Geneva. There's GaryCon, which is held upon the anniversary of Gary Gygax's death. But if Lake Geneva really threw their weight behind it, other people have described going to Lake Geneva as akin to visiting Mecca, because it is the birthplace of role-playing games. And going and seeing the old TSR buildings is a religious experience. You go and see the house where Gary Gygax played games on the porch with other luminaries, and you walk the streets that he walked, and you see the things that he saw. And people have, like David M. Ewald has a whole chapter about going to GaryCon, describing it as this religious pilgrimage for him. And given how core Dungeons & Dragons and role-playing is to the identity of many of us, it kind of makes sense.
All right. Well, very interesting to learn so much about a game that I think so many of us have experience with. Ben, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
It's been my pleasure, Joy. Have me back anytime.
Ben Riggs is a Dungeons and Dragons historian and the author of Slaying the Dragon, A Secret History of Dungeons and Dragons. We spoke in 2022. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll meet the first Black woman to hold the title of Miss Wisconsin. Plus, we'll tell you about Yerkes Observatory near Lake Geneva and the one-of-a-kind telescope you can see there. Thanks so much for joining us right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.